On this week's show, it's been powering cars for 100 years, but with diesels, hybrids, and electrics becoming more popular, how many miles are left on the internal combustion engine? Coming up next on Autoline This Week. Underwriting for Autoline This Week has been provided by BorgWarner. And now, here's your host, John McElroy.
I want to thank you all for joining us on Autoline This Week. Today's discussion is going to be about powertrain, especially going into the future. Are we going to be driving piston engines, or are they going away? How about fuel cells? And of course, what about battery electrics? Well, I've got three experts to talk about that today, including David McShane. He's the Vice President of Business Development at a company called Ricardo, which is actually based in the UK, though David is not. Paul Whitaker is the Powertrain and Technical Director for AVL Powertrain Engineering, a company, interestingly, that's based in Austria. And Dean Tomaszek is the Executive Vice President and Chief Technology Officer for FEV North America, a company which is based in Germany. So we've got a great representation from around the world. We're going to get some good viewpoints. David, I'm going to throw it out to you, but I'd ask Dean and Paul to jump in as well. Is there any life left in the piston engine, or is it coming to the end of its life?
Oh, there's plenty of life left in the piston engine. You know, even today we're looking at boosted technologies to improve fuel efficiency and start-stop generators to improve fuel efficiency. Looking forward, we'll probably see more high boosting of engines, improving efficiency even further, even before we see, you know, the full advent of electric vehicles. So there's plenty of life left in the piston engine.
Paul, do you see it the same way? And of course, when David mentions boosting, he's talking turbocharging and supercharging.
Yes, I think there's a lot of life left. I think we're seeing big efficiency improvements with engines today and see the potential for a lot more in the future. I think they're still very inexpensive relative to the other options. And of course, the energy density of gasoline and diesel is very hard to beat with battery storage. So I think there's a lot of life left.
Okay, and Dean, same question.
No, absolutely. I agree with both of my colleagues here. There's a lot of life left. I would call it more evolutionary than revolutionary. So there are small steps we take with already existing technologies, not only from a hardware perspective, but also from a controls perspective. Software development goes along with that. How do we control these technologies and how do we make them work better interactively? But there is a lot of other technologies still out there that as of now is still kind of too expensive, but we're getting there in order to meet all the legislative targets. Variable compression ratio mechanism is, for instance, one of them that's still a pretty big hammer that is not in production yet, but we're getting very close.
Okay, explain variable compression, and how do you do that at a price that the average consumer can afford?
Yeah. Well, first of all, let me say that the low-hanging fruit, so to speak, from a cost perspective is almost gone. So now, in order to meet the next legislative hurdles in meeting fuel economy, meeting CO2 emissions, we have to look at pricier options. Variable compression ratio mechanism is such an option. What it does, basically, it's a mechanism that based on speed, engine speed and load, it changes the compression ratio. It could be continuous, it could be a two-step mechanism, but what it allows you to do is basically run at part load with a high compression ratio, meaning the highest possible overall brake thermal efficiency you can have, and then when you need higher power as you increase the load in the engine, then you basically switch down to a lower compression ratio that mitigates knock, less enrichment, hence better fuel economy. Or, on the other hand, you could also say, with that, I could even push my power even further out. So it can be a fuel economy solution, it can be also a performance solution when we look at the high load operation. But it's a very good mechanism that can be incorporated into engines. We already have fleets running on the road, small development fleets, and it works very well. And I think that's part of, or one part of the future solutions that we will see in production.
Paul, what other technologies might we see that would extend the life of the internal combustion engine?
There's a lot of work ongoing to refine the gasoline combustion process and see further improvements from the turbocharged downsized engines we have today. I guess one of the leading technologies is Millercycle, which provides a lot of the benefit that we'd see from increasing compression ratio.
Wait. No, that's so, a new one on me. So what's Millercycle?
It's effectively a way of increasing the expansion stroke so we can get more efficiency out of the fuel that we burn, but reducing the compression ratio, which is what causes the engine to knock, by using different valve timing events. So we find that maybe 4 to 6% further benefit over a typical downsized direct injection gasoline engine.
So you're getting a longer stroke out of the engine with this millicycle,
yeah,
or how does that work?
Increasing the expansion stroke, but limiting the pressures and everything that cause the engine to knock.
Very interesting. Okay, mm-hmm. Okay, David, we've got two technologies here. What do you have on up your sleeve, as it were?
Well, I'd like to go back to the boosting. So we're seeing some boosting in engines today, but we see going forward, maybe even to the 2025 timeframe, extreme boosting in engines and engine technology.
What do you mean by extreme boosting?
So Ricardo did a high boost demonstrator where we were able to take, say, a baseline of a 2 liter natural gas, 2 liter naturally aspirated engine, and replace it with a 1 liter engine. So a 50% reduction actually in the engine size, and get the same performance out of it by adding in turbochargers, superchargers to actually boost the low end torque out of the engine, and essentially get the same performance. The whole use of electrification in this around the e-booster was around using electrical energy intelligently. So instead of adding on expensive batteries or things like that, using advanced lead acid batteries and even supercapsor to recapture the energy whenever you're braking, so that you can actually put it right back into the electric supercharger. So again, we're seeing maybe 40% reduction in CO2 out of these types of technologies. So again, there's a long way to go in internal combustion engines.
40% reduction is a huge reduction in, mm-hmm. in CO2. But let me throw this out to the panel here then. I love turbocharged engines. I love the drivability that they give. But as you downsize these engines, you tend to be in turbo boost a whole lot more, and it eats up a lot of the fuel economy savings. Is there a solution around that?
Mm-hmm. One of the solutions we've been looking at for a while is electric superchargers, as mm-hmm. I think Dave mentioned there, where basically have an electric motor driving a compressor similar to that found on a conventional turbocharger, and then we can use that at low speed to improve torque momentarily. Mm-hmm. So that provides some big benefits and helps a vehicle with a turbocharged engine drive as though it was a naturally aspirated engine, and really help in terms of transient response and drivability.
So you get the boost when you need it,
yes,
but then you don't have a parasitic loss when you don't need it.
That's right. Yeah.
When are we going to see this? Because electric turbos have been talked about for a number of years now.
Well, I think Audi have plans, if they haven't launched it already, to launch this year with a diesel engine mm-hmm. in one of their performance vehicles.
Yep.
And then we expect to see more and more with gasoline engines going forward, especially with the advent of 48-volt systems.
Mm-hmm. And I, go ahead, Dean.
Yeah, you're right. 48-volt certainly is a big enabler when we talk about e-charging, but there are other systems, of course. You can basically mix and match any way you want it, with a turbocharger, with a supercharger, with an e-charger. You can have two-stage turbocharging. Also there, just with the turbocharger, there's a lot of work going on, going from fixed geometry, wastegated, to VTG. Technology, so variable turbine geometry, that gives you more flexibility, especially with the Miller cycle, where you want to have higher boost mm-hmm. at the low speed, low load. That is additional flexibility that was in the past kind of a no-go because of cost. The technology is kind of there, but it's very expensive. Some of the technologies, whether we look at EGR at higher loads, whether we look at variable compression ratio mechanism, reduces the exhaust gas temperatures, which is what we want, because we want to extract as much energy out of the exhaust or the gas inside the cylinders for the working cycle. Naturally, then it cools off more. That actually allows us then to apply technologies such as a VTG turbocharger, giving us more flexibility at lower cost.
I was going to say, we also find that some of these advanced boosting systems are very good in terms of improving efficiency, because they're driven using exhaust gas, so mm-hmm. waste heat, and if we can recover some of that, then mm-hmm. we increase the efficiency of the engine.
Yeah.
So we have a lot of work ongoing looking at that. Right.
And there are good examples out there for gasoline applications, where we already look at two-stage turbocharging. We're looking at specific power output of 150 to 200 kilowatt per liter, which is, if we go back 5 to 10 years, they would have said you are crazy if you would have said that.
Yeah.
Nowadays, this is exactly what we're all working on, yeah, frankly speaking, and this is where we go. And it's just, how can you get there with the best system, robust system? Is it a two-stage? When we look at diesel applications, there are systems out there now with four turbochargers, two-stage for a six-cylinder inline. I mean, it's all there. It all can be done. How do you control it? Again, controls, I think, very, very important. People always underestimate the effort that is required in order to make it a nice package for the driver, smooth transition, good launch behavior. This is very important for the consumer as well.
David, I'm intrigued by what you're saying of going to this hyper boosting where you can cut the size of the engine in half. How small are they going to go? I mean, you're talking to a liter. There's a number of engines out there that are just 1 liter in displacement. Mm-hmm. Elsewhere in the world outside of the U.S. market, that's not that uncommon. But I guess the question still stands, how small might we see engines get?
So we've already demonstrated getting down to 50% reduction. People are even working on 60% reduction on engine sizes already. I'd like to pick up on something that Paul was saying about 48 volts. I think that's an incredibly important stepping stone as we move towards more plug-ins and to batteries, waiting for the cost of batteries to come down. 48-volt system is actually a key enabler to actually improving efficiency as well, and getting weight out of the system as well, as you add more electrification, intelligent electrification, so use it back where the engine is. So it's a big step forward, and I think going forward in 2025 timeframe, you'll see a lot more 48-volt systems actually onboard vehicles as we do go towards extreme downsizing, two-cylinder engines, three-cylinder engines, instead of what we have today.
So when you talk 48-volt, you're really talking a mild hybrid, right?
Mild hybrid, micro hybrid type technology.
Explain that a little bit for those in the audience who don't understand it, and I'm not capable of explaining it to them.
Okay. Well, certainly, you know, where you're adding in electrification towards the main traction engine, you can add electric boosting and electric powertrains directly onto the main drive shaft of the vehicle. But as you go through other configurations, we talk about P0, P1, P2, P3, P4, those types of configurations move the electric motor assist further and further away from the engine, between the engine and the transmission, and clutch it, and then moving on to the other side of the transmission system. And that enables other features on board vehicles to either go into sailing mode, where you're actually taking the internal combustion engine off the powertrain so that you can actually coast and get more efficiency out of the system that way. And then moving the electric motor back actually onto the rear differential. So you're moving further away to get more benefits out of the system. So there's a long way to go with the introduction of 48-volt systems onto powertrain. But it is a stepping stone between that and full plug-in hybrids and also battery electric vehicles.
And Paul, I got to imagine the reason for this move to 48-volt, which seemingly is going to go across the industry, is it's just a lot cheaper than going with a full strong hybrid or a battery electric.
Yeah, exactly. It's all about cost-effective fuel economy and how can you improve the efficiency over a 12-volt system. And that means you can use more electric boost into the driveline or more energy recuperation from braking and start to electrify some of the accessories on the engine, and try and do that without going to the full cost of a much higher voltage electrical system.
I've heard, and I don't know if this ratio is right, that a 48-volt system can give you something like 80% of the benefits of a full strong hybrid, but for about 30% of the cost or something along those
something
lines.
Like that. All these benefits are really, you know, application specific, and it depends on how it's applied. You know, there are all these different ways of electrifying, and it depends where you put the motor and different benefits that we can see from different approaches, but that seems reasonable, maybe 6 to 8% benefit.
At 6 to 8% is nothing to sneeze at these days, is it?
Yeah, but you look at, you know, the OEMs, they look in terms of the cost per percent CO2 benefit, and that becomes very attractive.
Dean, about a decade ago, it seemed like everywhere I went in the industry, the automakers were talking about HCCI, homogeneous charge compression ignition, where you kind of make a diesel engine, or I should say a gasoline engine, behave more like a diesel engine. I haven't heard a whole lot of talk about that. Why not?
Because it's very difficult to control. Yeah, I have to come back to controls. But it has a lot of benefits. Actually, variable compression ratio mechanism is an enabler for it because you significantly increase the operating range for a controlled auto ignition or an HDCI, pretty much the same thing. But it is certainly difficult to control. It only works very well at a lower speed and lower part load. So you cannot expand it up to full load. That is not feasible. And that basically, with all the other advancements that have been made in other areas, that kept it kind of a back burner technology. It's still out there. People still work on it, but it's not the main focus right now.
Yeah, I think I'd add that when people started looking at HCCI, the advantage they were looking for was that you could run a gasoline engine lean like a diesel engine, start seeing those benefits, but the combustion process would reduce NOx emissions, which are always a problem with lean operation, down to a level that you could get by without the expensive lean NOx after treatment. And I think people have found that that isn't actually true, that you still need a good level of lean NOx after treatment, and you still need to carry that cost. And as Dean said, I think it works very well in a region where we're moving engines away from operating these days by operating these downsized engines. We're forcing them away from the region where HCCI works best.
And like you said, I mean, NOx, that was clearly the hope. But you still deal with very high CO and hydrocarbon emissions as part of that. And that is also something that is difficult to deal with. Yeah? So again, it has its pros, but there are also cons. And right now, I don't see it.
What do you think about fuel? And David, let me start with you in the sense that the internal combustion engine doesn't make all these emissions. It's the nasty stuff in the fuel that causes all these carbon and NOx and other GHGs and the like. You see the fuel changing at any time. I thought the EPA had an element as part of its CAFE standards that mandated a lowering of carbon in gasoline.
That's a really good point, actually, John. You know, certainly as you go forward, we could see that alternate fuels or lower carbon fuels will play a significant role. Perhaps even if we look at, you know, the introduction of higher percentages of ethanol into gasoline, and maybe one of the advantages without costing more on the vehicle side is to look at upping the minimum octane rating on fuels and allowing OEMs to optimize the compression ratio in engines, which would actually give an efficiency benefit without actually adding cost to the whole system. So you're absolutely right. The use of alternate fuels, the addition of ethanol blends would be a good improvement to actually drive efficiency.
Paul, do you see that happening? I know in Europe you get higher octane fuels than you do here. I know the engine people here have been calling for higher octane. What are your thoughts of that ever happening and perhaps taking more of the carbon out of gasoline as well?
Yeah, you're right there. I mean, you can't buy regular grade gasoline in Europe anymore, so it's mid-grade or premium. We're always hindered by the fact that we need to develop engines here to run on regular grade gasoline, and because of the lower octane number, then performance and fuel economy start to spiral downward. So it's a big challenge, and if we could optimize engines only to operate on premium fuel, then life would be a lot easier for us, and we'd be able to see much more of a benefit in terms of efficiency. But I think it's going to be very difficult to make the change, and especially when you look at the cost increase. I guess there's some precedent there, really, with ultra-low sulfur diesel that was introduced, and that was all that's available from that point onwards. If we could do the same with premium fuel and have only premium fuel available, then that would be good. But look at the difference between a gallon of premium fuel and regular, and it's significant. So it's very difficult.
It very much is. There's another precedent, too, because in the 1970s, we banned lead in gasoline. Yep. And there was a huge transition to go through in that on both the refining and the engine side, and we made it happen. So, but there is that cost issue, too, and the public doesn't want to see the cost of gasoline going up.
I think the other thing is ethanol. I mean, if ethanol was widely available, then our life as developers of gasoline engines would become much easier. We wouldn't need variable compression ratio on all of these technologies, and especially in terms of CO2 benefit, we would be able to compete very well with diesel, with gasoline engines running on ethanol.
Dean, any thoughts on that and fuel? Wouldn't you love to see less carbon in the fuel?
Well, of course, everybody, I think, does. There has been, like you said, a big push in the industry for high octane ratings. Europe, I think, leads by example. They are significantly higher than what we see here. It is proven that you can gain several percent in improvement in fuel economy if you have higher octane rating fuel available. I think it complements itself very well with other technologies. Coming back to the VCR technology, when you look at E100, for instance, as a fuel, let's go to the extreme. If you run E100 in the current engine, you have a fixed low compression ratio. If you take a flex fuel engine, that okay, could go up to E85. But what are you going to do? You're stuck with your gasoline-based compression ratio. If you have a variable compression ratio, you can push it out much further, meaning you can generate much higher power. You can actually take advantage of the higher octane rating. The same thing is true for a CNG gasoline vehicle. Same thing there. Very high octane rating, 130. You cannot take advantage of it. You really can't because you don't push your compression ratio out because you are fixed to the lowest possible allowable level, which is based on the use of gasoline.
Just to come back to your thoughts on the low cost of gasoline, maybe that's one of the challenges of today because low cost gasoline is part of the challenge of actually meeting the CAFE requirements. Because consumer choice is being driven towards larger vehicles and SUVs, and that's certainly in the midterm review, part of the challenge of actually meeting 54.5 miles per gallon. Based on the current mix, which is now looking more like 50-50 instead of 67 against 33% of the larger vehicles, the EPA is now projecting that the CAFE target for 2025 will be more like 50.8 miles per gallon. So I'm not one to advocate this, but maybe a higher price of fuel based on a higher octane rating might be a good thing to help drive efficiency and consumer choice.
Well, David raised this. Paul, let me throw it to you. Do you think the industry can meet the 54.5 target with the powertrain mix that it has right now?
I think technically, yes. And I think with the technology that's been developed for the future, I think so as well. I think the challenge is, as Dave said, is you know, to produce vehicles that people want to buy, which is very difficult when fuel prices are so low.
Dean, what do you think? Can they meet? Can the industry meet this CAFE standard?
Yes, I think they can. Of course, the public has made it much more difficult at these fuel prices. Everybody is going towards an SUV. Everybody wants a pickup truck again. We have seen reverse developments few years back. But yes, it can be done. But it's getting more difficult if the fuel price stays that low.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I read in the Wall Street Journal today, a third of the gas stations across the country have gasoline at less than $2 a gallon. So it makes it extremely challenging.
Mm-hmm. It really does. Although what I find so interesting, too, is this move to crossovers, because that's really where the big shift is coming, is a global phenomenon. It's happening in Europe. It's happening in China. It's happening everywhere. Yeah. And as you guys know, the price of fuel in Europe is significantly higher. It's three, four times what it is here. If gas is under $2 a gallon, it's definitely four times more expensive. And yet we're seeing a change there, too. So we're getting down to the end here. Dean, I'll start with you. Does electrification really start to take off at some point? And I'm talking pure battery electric vehicles at this point. And if it does take off, when?
So electrification, again, is a big term. If you focus on EVs, then it'll be further out there. Because when we look at 2025 and whether we are looking now at 54.5 miles per gallon and 163 grams CO2, or whether we look at maybe 50 or 51 miles per gallon, the engine technologies that are out there still have a lot to offer. So there is some electrification, but certainly not to the extent of an EV in a wide sense. Micro hybrids, mild hybrids, maybe some strong hybrids, PHEVs, they will take off, but also at a lower rate. And hence, I can only reinforce what we said at the very beginning. The combustion engine has a lot of life left, and it will be the main carrier, I believe, still towards 2025.
Mm-hmm. And how do you see it there, Paul?
I think battery electric vehicles are, you know, significantly much more expensive than the ICE engine alternatives. You know, maybe twice as much in some cases. And I think it's I think the automakers realize it's difficult to pass that cost on to the customer. And I think they're absorbing some of that cost, and it's very difficult to be profitable with those vehicles. So it's very difficult at the moment. I think battery prices are going to come down and get to the point where it then becomes more economically viable. And at the same time, we need to see an increase in fuel prices for customers to really want to buy them. Mm-hmm. It's all going to happen. It's going to happen slowly. And I'm not sure when we're going to get to maybe 10, 15% of market share, but it's probably some time off yet.
Yeah. David, what are your thoughts on that?
Absolutely agree. And where we are right now is we're probably around $230 to $240 a kilowatt hour on a battery pack, let's say a 25 kilowatt hour battery pack. Until that gets down to more like $100 a kilowatt hour, We won't see a main shift over to battery electric vehicles. So there's still a lot of work to do in lithium chemistries to go forward to get that pricing down. And that's the main trigger to actually opening the floodgates to actually all moving towards electric vehicle. But there's some disruptors out there too. The introduction of iMobility type things, shared mobility. You know, there may be some disruptors that actually pull these on-demand services further forward. So the future's unwritten, but there's certainly enough game changers out there to move things forward.
Paul, that's a very interesting thought. Do you think this whole move to mobility could change the choices in powertrain?
I think the changes with mobility and rideshare schemes, for example, maybe combined with some level of autonomous driving is going to change the requirements, and it's certainly going to change the requirements for the powertrain and open up some opportunities for improved efficiency.
Dean, your thoughts on mobility and the impact on powertrain?
I think we will see an increase there clearly, but it will also highly depend on what the customer really wants. If I look at an autonomous vehicle that I use every day on the same basis, then I would select one powertrain. If I want to take that vehicle out on the weekend, though, and I drive on a nice curvy road and I want to be in control and I want to drive it and I want performance, that changes the whole picture. So what does the customer want? That will drive the selection, and there will be a lot of diversity. In general, what we see is much more diversity, many more options as we have ever seen in the past. And it will come down to what the customer wants and what he's willing to pay for.
And I think with that, we're going to have to wrap this up, but I think that's a good point to make. It's what the customer wants that's going to drive what we actually end up having. With that, I have to thank you all. David McShane, Paul Whitaker, Dean Tomaszek, thank you so much for coming on and talking about where we're going in the future with the powertrains and automobiles.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Underwriting for AutoLine this week has been provided by BorgWarner.